U.S. Airlines got a taxpayer-funded bailout. In Latin America, planes are mostly grounded.
I think it's indeed still seen as a luxury good that's only used by rich business people or by the rich and famous.
Also, it's said that the Philippines supplies the world's nurses. Right now, Filipino Americans are carrying a heavy load.
Having nurses or healthcare people in your family or friends or networks, the stories, it's personal.
Some bars and restaurants in Spain are reopening.
We have to keep 2 meters distance between tables, keeping the cleaning every time a table is used, washing hand dispensers everywhere.
And German soccer is back. It won't sound like that, though. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. Kids have largely been spared the health impacts of the coronavirus, so it has appeared. Doctors are now starting to reassess this. In very rare instances, the virus now appears to be associated with an extreme overreaction of the immune system in children, requiring intensive care. Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus, director of the World Health Organization, spoke earlier today.
I call on all clinicians worldwide to work with your national authorities and WHO to be on the alert and better understand this syndrome in children.
This rare reaction was already on Dr. Lorenzo D'Antiga's radar. He's a director of child health at the Papa Giovanni 23rd Hospital in Bergamo, Italy, and co-author of a new study published this week in The Lancet about what he and his colleagues observed in 8 children who tested positive for the coronavirus antibodies.
What happened in this period, that the Bergamo area has been hit very hard by the virus, and it was the first area hit in the Western countries. So in this period, at the beginning, we were concentrating in the respiratory issues, but then we realized that in children that was not very important. But what happened is that with some delay, we saw several children coming to our emergency department with the disease, which resembled Kawasaki disease. Actually, we classified it as Kawasaki disease.
Explain, first of all, what Kawasaki is.
Yes, Kawasaki disease is classified as a vasculitis, an inflammation of the medium-caliber arteries. It classically involves the heart, but it is a systemic disease appearing with high temperature for several days, not responding to antibiotics. And some other signs, for instance, inflammation of the oral mucosa, as well as some abnormalities of hands and feet.
So how do you treat this condition, what you call Kawasaki?
The treatment is really standardized. So we use immunoglobulin, which is antibodies, and then aspirin, intravenous aspirin, at the anti-inflammatory dosage. And in some patients, having factors predicting resistance to this treatment, we also give steroids. And these patients, all patients respond very well, usually.
Right. And from what I understand, all the children that you were overseeing, they all survived.
They did, yes. So we have seen 10 in about 15 days in March, and they are all back home, fit and well. But then we have seen another 10 eventually, so they are 20 altogether. We described only the first 10, but I can tell you that even the second 10 patients responded very well, and almost all are back home very well and very fit.
Dr. D'Antiga, I know that there are so many unknowns about coronavirus, but why do you think this is happening in some kids?
So what we think is happening is that a virus is triggering an immune response in the host, and it is not the virus itself causing the injury, but it is the host immune response elicited by the virus that is causing most of the injury. This is true also for the respiratory disease. But these children need to have a predisposition, because not all children getting infected develop Kawasaki, probably just one in a thousand.
So in some ways, it sounds like these kids' bodies are doing what they're supposed to do. They're just doing it in overdrive.
That's right. And this is what drives the injury through what we call a cytokine storm and the activation of macrophage, what we call MAS.
So as doctors start to reassess how they view this disease in kids in general, what do you advise parents to look out for?
Well, there is nothing to advise, I would say, because this disease presents with high temperature, so fever, which is not responding to antibiotics. So that's commonly a reason to bring the child to the doctor. So there are no special signs and there is no special warning. What is important is to for the doctors to be aware of this condition, recognize it early, and treat early, because some of these patients have a severe involvement and need to be treated promptly.
Dr. Dantiga, today at his press briefing, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo said that he believes this Kawasaki rare inflammatory syndrome will be much more widespread than anyone thinks. Do you think he's right to be making those warnings given the relatively limited scope of the study and research?
As I was telling you, we calculated that 1 in 1,000 children infected develop the disease. So at the moment, probably 10% of children in our province encounter the virus. But if the epidemic spread, probably we will see more.
I think it's worth emphasizing again, doctor, that this is an extremely rare condition, correct?
It is important, yes. We don't want to scare families. This remains a very rare disease. So one should not think that a child getting infected will develop Kawasaki, not at all. And very few children are predisposed to develop it. Many others will get infected and will have really no symptoms or, you know, very mild symptoms.
Dr. Lorenzo Dantiga is a director of child health at the Papa Giovanni 23rd Hospital in Bergamo, Italy. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Airlines everywhere have been decimated by the pandemic. In many countries, airlines are considered essential services, so governments are helping them get by. In Latin America, though, economies were already struggling when the pandemic hit. And as the world's Jorge Valencia reports, airlines there are now fighting for survival.
There's a Colombian movie from the 80s where a musician flies from Bogota to New York.
Mijito.
And his mother sees him off at the airport. She asks a flight attendant to take special care of her boy.
La señorita se encargará de todo.
¿Y dónde está el niño?
Mírelo aquí, mírelo.
The flight attendant asks, "Where's your boy?" And he's standing right there, a grown man in a suit and tie. People the world over have become much more used to traveling by air. Colombia now has one large airline and a number of smaller ones, including low-cost carrier Viva Air.
Yeah, I'm Felix Antelo, president and CEO for Viva Air Group.
And Antelo says business was good. Last year, Colombia's aviation industry grew by 10%, Viva Air grew by 40%. Antelo was planning on taking the company public and adding new destinations.
Yeah, I mean, we up until 2 months ago, we were looking to flying into Quito. We were looking also to fly into Costa Rica in San Jose. And we were looking into flying into Orlando in the U.S.
Then the coronavirus hit, and all commercial airlines in Colombia were grounded. The airlines saw virtually all their revenue disappear. Now they're asking for help.
We are in advanced conversations with the government for a bridge loan, which is around $50 million, 5-0. Which is what Viva needs to get through this and restart the operation and be a relevant actor, you know, once air traffic is back in Colombia.
This is a controversial request. Altogether, Colombia's airlines are asking the government for $1.2 billion in help. Most of that money would go to the country's biggest airline, Avianca. It filed for bankruptcy protection in New York this week. Now, that's way less than the $25 billion bailout airlines received in the U.S., but Colombia is a country where a quarter of the population was already living under the poverty line before the pandemic. Tomás Serabrinsky is an economist with the Inter-American Development Bank.
So they are allocating those resources to more immediate and urgent needs, like the need to revamp the health system or provide income support to the most vulnerable poor of the population.
Colombia's three largest carriers employ more than 15,000 people. And across Latin America, the airlines are vital to the tourism industry. But most leaders there are reluctant to give them support. Just 2 years ago, Mexico's president canceled construction for a new airport in Mexico City because he said it wouldn't benefit the working class. Dijs Bonekum is an economist with SEO Amsterdam Economics, a think tank in the Netherlands.
I think it's indeed still seen as a luxury good that's only used by rich business people or by the rich and famous. But now, low-cost travel has made air travel much more accessible.
And low-cost airlines in Colombia, such as Viva Air and Wingo Air, want to keep it that way. Carolina Cortizo is the managing director of the Bogota-based Wingo Air.
There's nothing that I want more is that my planes are our planes are back in the sky. So the team has been putting a huge effort into the back to normal of our airline.
Cortizo says they're looking at how to contain costs. She says airlines are already working on ways to get back in business despite the pandemic.
You arrive to the airport and only the people that are going to fly are actually going to be allowed into the airport. You'll have a temperature, taking the temperature of the passengers coming in. We'll probably have counters with separations with the passengers.
And Cortizo says passengers will likely be required to wear masks and stand 6 feet apart during boarding. The Colombian government is asking for the middle seat on airplanes to be left empty. But before you get your hopes up, though, Cortizo says that just won't make financial sense.
If that happens, we can't sustain our low-cost promise because we would have basically a third of our capacity shredded and we would have to sell tickets to compensate at a rate that compensates not having those extra seats.
Wingo Air is also asking the government for a loan. Cortizo says it's less than $13 million. Right now, Colombian officials say the country's airlines could be back in the skies no sooner than next month. For the world, I'm Jorge Valencia.
It is Friday, and here's a fun weekend plan for you, the Eurovision Song Contest. It's the pandemic edition of Eurovision. The annual International Singing Contest will look a little different this year. Instead of an in-person finale, a virtual show called Eurovision, Europe Shine a Light will air tomorrow, with no voting and no winner, which does take a bit of the fun away, yeah, but the show still promises the usual shocks and delights. Viewers will see performances of the 41 songs that would have been included in the 2020 competition. Italy's entry has gotten some major pickup on social media already. Rising star Diodato with a power ballad called Fai Rumore. Since the coronavirus, Diodato's love song has taken on a whole new meaning in Italy. The lyrics translate to, "Make noise, I can't stand this unnatural silence between you and me." It's one of the many songs Italians have united around and belted from their balconies. Another would-be top contender for the iconic glass microphone trophy is Iceland's entry. The six-person band Davio Gagnamagni, known for wearing matching green jumpsuits on stage, with their song Think About Things. And from Bulgaria, you'll hear an atypical Eurovision Song Contest entry. But what is typical Eurovision? Singer Victoria was expected to score high with the haunting melody in her song, Tears Getting Sober. Aside from singing their own entries, the 2020 artists will also join together virtually to sing Love Shine a Light, the 1997 Eurovision winner by Ireland's Katrina and the Waves. Fun fact, Ireland holds the most Eurovision titles. They've won 7 of the 64 contests. More than 40 countries will broadcast this year's show, the 65th edition. No matter where you are, you can watch the live stream on the Eurovision Song Contest YouTube channel. Exciting! You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. You're with the world. Typhoon Vong Fong made landfall in the Philippines yesterday with 96-mile-an-hour winds. It's weakening today, but still threatens the northern Philippines and Taiwan during a pandemic. Patrick Nguyen is one of our Asia correspondents.
The problem is it's barreling towards one of the most densely populated islands in one of the most densely populated countries in Asia. It's the island of Luzon, which has Manila on it. And now you've got all these people trying to move to safety. And we're talking about maybe needing to move about 200,000 people. So it's a pretty chaotic environment.
So how do you safely evacuate people who are also facing this pandemic?
It's going to be very hard. What authorities are saying now is, please, if you have a mask as you're evacuating, you've got to wear it. I don't think they're going to turn anyone away if they don't have one, but please put on a mask. The other thing they're trying to do is keep evacuation centers half full so people can try to do some social distancing. The Philippines gets 20 nasty typhoons a year, so they're used to the typhoons, but they're not used to having to spread people apart in these evacuation centers. So what they're saying is churches, schools, please take in people so that we can spread people out when they're evacuating.
So what has the Philippines been doing already to fight the coronavirus, Patrick?
Well, they've taken it pretty seriously. About half the country is under lockdown. The entire area where the storm is hitting, that area is definitely under lockdown. And so it's really tough because in the Philippines, a lot of houses are just not very stable. And these homes are often really crowded too. So you've got people who are already struggling to quarantine. What they're trying to do in the Philippines is set people up in tents outside hospitals. That's something that they've done to take on people who are in really crowded dwellings already. But those tents may blow away because of the typhoon. President Duterte, who's a pretty stern figure, has said, if everyone doesn't behave and honor the quarantine and honor the lockdowns, then we might have to institute martial law. Well, now it looks like it's really hard to, quote unquote, behave. And that will make all of these really stern measures next to impossible, at least while the storm is raging.
What have authorities in the Philippines been saying about how this typhoon event could risk exacerbating the pandemic's effects?
What they're really worried about is squishing people together. I mean, if you have one family in a dwelling that has been trying to do the right thing and tried to stay inside, even if they have 8, 9, 10 people in that dwelling, at least that's a small cluster. But now you've got tens of thousands of people all looking for shelter. If you're a virologist, you're looking at this with some amount of fear because it's a really easy way for the virus to spread.
The World's Asia correspondent, Patrick Nguyen, thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
If you've spent any time in a hospital or have dealt with home health care issues in your family, there's a good chance a Filipino-American was there to help. In the U.S., people of Filipino descent make up just 1% of the population, but 7% of health care workers. During the pandemic in New York City, a group in the neighborhood Little Manila, that's in Queens, has stepped up and is taking care of their own. Reporter Rosalind Tordesillas has our story.
This is a sidewalk sing-along from a tour through the Little Manila neighborhood in New York. It paid tribute to Filipinos' love of karaoke. That was last fall, before COVID-19 hit. On May 1st, the sounds were different at a rally outside nearby Elmhurst Hospital. Filipino community groups demanded protection for healthcare workers. In the New York area, nearly a quarter of adults of Filipino descent work in the field. That's not news to Jacqueline Reyes.
You can't talk to any Filipino in New York who doesn't know a nurse or a healthcare worker.
Reyes is not a nurse. She's an artist and was working on projects in Little Manila. Xenia Diente was her co-artist.
Having nurses or healthcare people in your family or friends or networks, the stories, it's personal.
So they collaborated with Little Manila restaurants to bring Pinoy food to healthcare facilities with lots of Filipinos. They joined forces with the National Alliance for Filipino Concerns, which has ties with nurses and doctors. Next, they raised money to pay for the food. The meals would be donated to workers. That's how the project, Meal to Heal, was born.
We knew that even the people who work at the restaurants, who own these restaurants, are deeply tied to the healthcare workers.
Healthcare is part of Little Manila's origin story. It goes back to the early 1900s, when the U.S. recruited people from the Philippines, a colony then, to fill healthcare shortages across the country. Since the 60s, a lot of these workers settled here. Then came the grocery stores and restaurants. Normally, when the train doors open at the Woodside subway stop, you inhale the aroma of Filipino barbecue.
If I have a craving for home, like for my family's kind of cooking and to hear Tagalog or any Philippine language being spoken, I would go there. So I think of Little Manila as a kind of portal to this memory of home or the motherland.
The community's ties to healthcare persist. It helped shape Xenia Diente's identity.
Up until I was 12 years old, I didn't know that Filipina women could be anything but nurses. When I met Filipina women that were anything else, my jaw just dropped. It's like, what?
Ready to deliver.
Ready to deliver.
Elmer's Hospital.
Elmer's Hospital.
Yeah.
One of Meal to Heal's restaurants is called Amazing Grace. It's co-owned by Mary Jane De Leon, who is also a nurse. Recently, she assisted at a COVID ICU. She saw the tough work close up, so she put extra care into the meals.
Tapos yun, kung ano yung gusto nilang mangyari, yung dinagdagan na.
She says she'd add special rice or a dessert to the orders. She was glad to help. Help people like Cherry Pabellonia. She's a dialysis nurse in Queens. She says before the virus, the mostly Filipino staff shared food. Not anymore. We talked over a staticky phone line.
So now we are very paranoid. Everybody's paranoid. It changes everybody.
That paranoia vanished when a delivery from Meal to Heal arrived. She said the staff took joy in food again.
So everybody's happy. Oh, you know, there's dinuguan, there's pancit, you know.
She was thrilled to get favorites like dinuguan, a pork blood stew, and pancit, a traditional noodle dish. But for now, she can't say thanks to those who made and delivered it in person. In a video of one of the deliveries, two employees from Amazing Grace haul a box of food from their car and drop it off with a hospital security guard. That's it. They don't see a single nurse or doctor who'll eat the meals. That's okay, Reyes says. It's all part of the Bayanihan spirit, the community coming together. When Filipinos hear Bayanihan, many picture a classic scene from rural parts of the Philippines, when wooden thatched roof houses are moved to a new place, a huge task that takes extra hands.
If you had someone in a village who wanted to physically move their house, you would get your neighbors and your friends to actually carry your house to wherever you are moving to.
In these times of isolation, Bayanihan brings your home to wherever you need it to be. For the world, Rosalind Tordesillas, New York City.
Rice and pancit noodles, you can almost taste them in the photos. To see them, hop on over to theworld.org or join us on Twitter. We've got a new handle, even easier to remember. We are at the world. The economic turmoil is the worst since the Great Depression 90 years ago. Here, there, everywhere.
There's almost nowhere that's escaped.
Still, some countries have better roadmaps to contain the economic fallout.
It's a fairly quick response to the pandemic itself, so good public health response.
Making sense of the global economy, that's ahead here on The World. The World Health Organization has a dire warning for Africa. It says African countries could be looking at the deaths of 190,000 people from COVID-19, and nearly a quarter of a billion people on the continent could become infected with coronavirus. Dr. Matsidiso Moeti is the WHO's regional director for Africa.
We could have a situation where we are seeing widespread transmission of the virus and the health system is overwhelmed. I think what is very important is to put in place ways of caring for people that try to address the problem early, because we want to minimize the proportion of people who will get to the point of needing critical care, because we know that these types of facilities are not adequate by any means in the majority of African countries.
The new research from the WHO suggests that the spread of COVID-19 across Africa is likely to be slower than it's been in other parts of the world, but that it could continue to take a toll over the next several years. Dr. Ahmed Kalibi is CEO of the Lancet Group of Laboratories in East Africa.
So we have two problems. One, if COVID-19 actually hits the population as much as it is predicted, then a lot of people will die out of it. Number two is that other diseases that we are suffering from, HIV, TB, will end up being on the back burner and being neglected. And that's what's happening at the moment.
Of course, the impact of the coronavirus is already being felt there. The WHO says there are more than 75,000 coronavirus infections across 53 countries in Africa right now. And so far, more than 2,500 people have died. Lockdowns have disrupted daily life in many parts of Africa, and for Muslims in Nairobi, Kenya, that means Ramadan has a very different feel this year. The entire holy month cannot be shut down, even by a pandemic, but Muslims in Nairobi have adjusted how they're observing Ramadan. The World's Halima Gakandi has our story.
On a normal Friday during Ramadan, Ahmed Ali Mohammed would head to the mosque with his family and friends.
And then we'll head home and, you know, have a feast with friends and families and relatives, sometimes over my grandmother's or my mother's house. But this Ramadan has been very different.
Mohammed's mother and grandmother live in the mostly Muslim neighborhood of East Lee. He normally visits them often, but not these days.
All the mosques have been closed down. So everything is different. It's Ramadan, feels like Ramadan, you're fasting through the day, but when it comes to breaking the fast, it's really different. It's not Ramadan anymore because, you know, Ramadan used to bring people together.
Mohammed and his family have never been more apart. He lives less than 30 minutes away from his mother, but East Lee is now under a 15-day lockdown due to a spike in COVID-19 cases. Some have accused the government of discriminating against Muslims because the only two neighborhoods in the country put under lockdown are predominantly Muslim. Kenya's Interior Minister, Fred Matiang'i, met with Muslim leaders on Wednesday. He said the government isn't discriminating against anyone.
I want to urge you, my brothers, my Muslim brothers, that please let nothing divide us during this particular time.
Mohammed says he understands why certain areas have to be locked down. He points to a well-known saying or hadith from the Prophet Muhammad about what people should do during a pandemic or a plague.
Any place that is under quarantine, you shouldn't go in, and if you're inside, you shouldn't come out. You know, that's a hadith from the Prophet, peace be upon him.
But Mohammed still worries about his family. Police and soldiers have blocked the roads. Only essential workers are allowed in and out of the neighborhood.
Most of the people that used to come into East Lee are from outside. You know, the small traders, the ones who bring fresh groceries, they don't come to East Lee anymore. So they don't get that much of fresh groceries.
Food shortages are a problem in other areas, too. Mohammed is a trader in wholesale goods like sugar, flour, and rice. He says some items, like dates, a favorite Ramadan treat, are now hard to find.
We used to have dates, like lots of dates, you know, from mostly the Middle Eastern countries, you know, all North Africa. We don't get them because there are no goods that are coming into the country.
With the lockdown and business slow, Mohammed's spending Ramadan at home with his wife Fatima and their two children. Instead of going to the mosque to break the fast every evening, they turn on the TV or the computer.
Actually, majority of the mosques do have like YouTube pages. So you can follow the sermons even on YouTube. If it's Friday, you can watch the Friday sermons on YouTube. But you do have to pray at home.
Some mosques have their own TV channels, like the country's biggest one, Jamia Mosque, which closed for the first time in its 95-year history. It's been holding prayers online and bringing in doctors and experts to talk about the pandemic. I asked Mohammed if he watches the virtual mosque programs with his kids.
Yes, we do watch them together, but, you know, kids are kids. They'll go for the cartoons.
But there's one message Muslim leaders are trying to drive home. Here's Jamia Mosque's Sheikh Ibrahim Lathome.
You fall sick today, look for a doctor. Look for medicine. If Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants, He will put cure in that medicine. But you cannot sit down there and say, Mungu akipenda, if Allah so wills, I will get cured.
In other words, trust the science and listen to the doctors. For the world, I'm Halima Gikandi.
Few are buying, far less are flying. Dramatic changes to the economy are not isolated to the U.S., of course. Simon Cox is emerging markets editor for The Economist. He joins us from Hong Kong for the worldwide perspective. So, Simon, I guess there's bad and then there's really bad. How does this economic meltdown compare to the Great Recession back in 2008 or other downturns?
Well, it's far worse. It's far worse. I mean, if you look at the global economy as a whole, it actually takes quite a lot to make it shrink. And back in the global financial crisis, which was this unprecedented depression-like event, it shrank, but only a very small amount. This pandemic, though, is going to produce a convulsion, the likes of which we haven't seen since the Great Depression.
Yeah, so are we talking about the entire world being engulfed by this, or are there some areas that are harder hit than others and will continue to be harder hit?
There's almost nowhere that's escaped. If you look in Asia, Singapore has been very hard hit. It's obviously a hub, depends very much on people feeling free to move about. Thailand's been very hard hit because of the tourism industry. Then there are countries like Taiwan, China itself, that are going to come through it with actually less damage than some of their neighbors. Vietnam is another country that's been damaged, but less so.
Yeah, so what makes the difference between countries that are better positioned to weather the economic storm? You mentioned Vietnam. Like, what went right there? What did they have that kind of shielded them?
So it's a combination of two things. First, it's a fairly quick response to the pandemic itself. So good public health response, you know, including surveillance, tracking. Vietnam actually has quite a lot of experience of dealing with flus of various kinds. So it was set up to sort of deal with this. It has high state capacity, to use the term. And then the second thing is reasonably robust economic position at the beginning. So countries that were able to respond to this slowdown with a fair amount of stimulus, perhaps because their fiscal situation wasn't too stretched beforehand, perhaps their central banks had room to cut interest rates. Those things combined are what you really need to come through this with the minimum damage.
So the U.S. and China have been sparring, but that's really been happening since Trump came into office. Trump has long talked about shifting production away from China. Do you think the pandemic could achieve what Trump so far has not been able to do? And what could the implications be for other countries in China's orbit and in the kind of U.S.-China orbit?
Yeah, so we have seen some of that. There is some sense supply chains are going to get shorter. There's an announcement just this week that one of the big Taiwan semiconductor factories would set up a plant in the U.S. Now, that comes with some efficiency costs. You know, it's obviously more efficient to produce goods wherever they're cheapest to produce. But I suppose for the populists and the people who are very keen to repatriate manufacturing, they'll see this perhaps as a good side of the pandemic.
From an economic standpoint, is this year a total write-off and more focus is just going to be put on 2021? Or is it too soon to even focus on 2021?
Well, it's a little bit staggered. So, you know, the countries that got hit first are going to recover first, China being the most obvious example. So for those countries, they can hope to see some sort of recovery in the second half of this year. Everyone else is going to have to wait until 2021. And even then, it's going to be a very qualified recovery. You know, we might get back to where we were in late 2019, but we're never going to get back to where we would have been if this pandemic had never struck. And it's important to bear that in mind, I think.
Now, Simon, just help us understand finally why it seems that is the case, but markets globally are shaken, but not really stirred to the degree that a lot of fearmongers were predicting.
Yeah, no, that's quite interesting. That's partly because of the response of central banks. They've been very active, I think, commendably so, in trying to ensure financial stability. It's also because, you know, financial markets are very forward-looking, so they're pricing not just this year's earnings, not just next year's earnings, but the next 20 years' earnings. And over that kind of time scale, you know, perhaps the pandemic begins to look like a smaller event. And it's also, they've clearly just got a bit carried away. I think there was quite a lot of cash on the sidelines looking for buying opportunities. And the fear of missing out kicks in quite quickly once the sort of fear of losses subsides. And so I think, you know, the rally got a bit ahead of itself. And we're already seeing this week some pullback.
Simon Cox is the emerging markets editor for The Economist. He's been speaking with us from Hong Kong. Simon, thank you very much. Stay safe and have a great weekend.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Spain has been one of Europe's hardest hit countries by the coronavirus. They are now past the peak, though. Big cities like Madrid and Barcelona remain largely closed, but some parts of Spain saw a partial easing of the lockdown this week. Tony Sanchez is co-owner of a restaurant called the Moss Bar in a small coastal town in Catalonia. Tony, thanks for being here. You reopened Monday. It's now Friday. How's business so far?
Well, thank you for letting me speak in your program. Well, we are doing good step by step. First day was a bit crazy because people, after 2 months of being in closure, they went out all together. So we have to please go down. But they now are behaving correctly, you know, keeping social distance. Now on Friday, we are doing good. Only at 50% of the terrace, but it's all going flawless.
And so how does that compare to a regular night before the virus?
Before the virus, we probably have more capacity. So, you know, the government here in Spain, they only let you open 50% on your capacity, only outside on the terrace. We have to keep 2 meters distance between tables on the terrace. And
right,
it's not
that's
allowed
about 6 feet like here.
Yeah, and it's not allowed to open inside at the moment, okay? So we also only are doing self-service and, of course, a lot of cleaning, you know, washing hand dispensers everywhere. But it's all good. You know, people is behaving correctly, no problem.
So one by one, you place your order, you pick up your order. Can you eat in the restaurant? Do you have to eat on the terrace or it's strictly takeout at this point?
Well, now we are doing strictly takeout. We only let the customers drink on the tables right now. So for the food, this week, we are only testing for takeaway only.
Right. How are the restrictions enforced? How will they be enforced? Do the police come and check on you?
Yeah, sure. The police, they came the first day just to check we were doing the correct distance between the tables. And they are always going here every day just to check everything is okay. But it's all going good with them.
And what about your staff during the lockdown? What happened to them?
During the lockdown, all the staff, you know, the Spanish government, they allowed us to keep them in what we call here an ERTE. So it's like the government pays them for the social security cost.
Right, a safety net.
Yes.
So if all goes according to plan, more restrictions will be lifted. What's going to happen next for the Moss Bar?
We want to go on 100%, but probably this summer we're going to keep all the business running out on the terrace. You know, we expect good weather in Spain, as usual. So our plan this year is stay outside and let's see what happens when the summer finish.
I know you're famous for your cocktails at the Moss Bar. What is your most popular cocktail and do you do that takeout too?
Yes. We are now doing our mojito cocktail. We do the base here in the bar so you can take the ice separately and you finish the cocktail in your house. So
nice.
We're trying different things, you know.
Are you drinking on the terrace while you're waiting for your food?
Yeah, well, yes, sure.
So if I'm sitting on the terrace right now at Moss Bar, what's the music on your playlist? What's popular these days?
Well, we are a bit British, you know. Yeah, you know, we like the 80s music. So probably an 80s playlist, you know, with Duran Duran or, you know, these things.
Yeah, do you have a favorite Duran Duran track?
In Rio, it's you know, the Rio album, I think it's one of my favorites, yeah.
Tony Sanchez, co-owner of the Moss Bar, a restaurant in Catalunya, Spain. Thank you very much for your time and good luck with the reopening. Hope it goes well.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
The 1918 influenza pandemic was a huge historic event. It infected roughly one-third of the entire global population. Yet until this current pandemic, odds are you probably haven't thought much about it. There aren't many great pandemic novels like there are about World War I, the event it coincided with. No All Quiet on the Western Front or Johnny Got His Gun for the influenza. Though Downton Abbey fans may remember this moment when Matthew Crowley's fiancée, Lavinia, got the flu.
I don't understand. When I was with her, she was talking. She was fine.
It's a strange disease with sudden, savage changes.
Scholar Elizabeth Outka has been looking at this. She's the author of Viral Modernism, The Influenza Pandemic, and Interwar Literature.
I call it a perfect storm of silence because I think that there's a lot of factors that go into why the influenza pandemic drops out of cultural memory. But a lot of it does have to do with the timing. It comes right as the war is ending, and the deadly second wave came right at armistice. In fact, a lot of people were infected with influenza in the armistice celebrations. And so you have a lot of people just overwhelmed with grief, overwhelmed with mass death. You know, it's 8 to 10 million people who die in World War I, and people had just had enough.
So perhaps the experience of the pandemic comes through art and literature in more subtle, maybe unexpected ways. You also argue that the idea of zombies, the undead monsters who come back and infect other humans, that can be traced back to the same period. How?
What you have is this combination of factors from the war and the pandemic. You have bodies that have been disfigured in the war or from the pandemic. This influenza turned people purple. It caused profuse bleeding from eyes, nose, and mouth. And you have all this insecure burial, right? You have so many missing soldiers. You have so many mass graves. And in the flu, the worst wave came in the middle of winter when it was hard to dig. And then you have this invisible enemy that is also contagious. You could give it to other family members. You could pass it on. Mm. And so all of these factors combine. And lurching out of this come these proto-zombie figures with a writer like H.P. Lovecraft. And in a very famous movie, J'accuse, by the French director Abel Gance. It was a way, I think, also of visualizing a monster that was invisible in the case of the flu.
What other ways did kind of culture producers come to terms with the pandemic? Like Arthur Conan Doyle, the author of the Sherlock Holmes series, he has an interesting role here.
We have a resurgence of what was called spiritualism after the war and the pandemic, which was an attempt to contact the dead through seances. Ouija boards became very popular. And so Arthur Conan Doyle, who created Sherlock Holmes, was extremely interested in spiritualism. His son is often reported as having died from injuries of the war, but that's actually incorrect. He was injured in the war, but he dies of influenza when he comes back, along with Arthur Conan Doyle's younger brother. And so Arthur Conan Doyle throws himself into spiritualism. He's coming to the United States and giving sold-out talks at Carnegie Hall. And he's showing these spirit photographs where you have a living sitter, and then in the background somewhere, there's a ghostly figure of ideally one of their relatives. Now, to our eyes, these seem like obvious frauds, but at the time, it offered a tangible way to bring back somebody who had died in these terrible ways. And it was a way of handling that kind of grief and giving somebody a visual that they could hang on to.
So, Elizabeth, you've written a book about this subject. Obviously, you started working on it long before the current coronavirus pandemic. But now that we're all living this strange experience, were there any particular works that you've read before that kind of took on a new relevance for you?
One of the poems that I write about in the book is the famous poem by William Butler Yeats, The Second Coming. Mm. And it is a poem very much about the war. It is very much about all the things that were happening in Ireland. But when I had my own sort of COVID-like case in March, I remembered lying in bed, sort of semi-delirious, and thinking about the rhythmic quality of these lines and the way they produce or suggest a kind of delirium, this turning and turning, and things fall apart. The center cannot hold, mere anarchy is loosed upon the world, right? These are all lines that spoke to the kind of bodily disintegration, this sort of sense that there was anarchy outside your window and anarchy inside your body. And Yeats writes this poem just a couple weeks after his pregnant wife had barely recovered from her almost deadly case of influenza.
Elizabeth Outka is a professor at the University of Richmond. She's the author of Viral Modernism, the Influenza Pandemic, and Interwar Literature. Elizabeth, we are glad you're healthy. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much, Marco. It was a pleasure.
When did the coronavirus outbreak become a reality in your world? For many American sports fans, that day was March 11th.
Game tonight has been postponed. You're all safe.
The anguish there when the NBA decided to postpone its season. Since then, the dominoes have fallen worldwide, with league after league shutting their doors. Now, in dribs and drabs, sports are coming back. Baseball in South Korea, horse racing in France, and tomorrow the Bundesliga, Germany's premier soccer league. Just don't expect this weekend's matches to sound like that. Games will be Geisterspiele, German for ghost games, played in empty stadiums under strict conditions.
Can't believe it's happening. It feels somewhat surreal. It still feels weird.
That's Union Berlin defender Nevin Subotic. This weekend, he'll throw on his jersey for the first time in more than 2 months. The league is doing as much as possible to protect everyone involved. Players will be tested twice a week. Soccer balls will be disinfected at halftime. Even with those measures, Nevin Subotic says it's a precarious situation.
It's just going to be a lot of risk management, trying to get to a finished season with the fewest casualties, so to say.
Subotic is happy to be reunited with his teammates, but he says playing just won't feel the same.
Fact of the matter is, we're not going to have games with fans. That's what makes it special, is having that collective moment of celebration.
The real celebration is when the cheers return.
The first game back with fans in the stadium. I'm looking forward to that. That's my end goal. And I don't know when that will happen, but that's the motivation I have.
There is a NASCAR event happening here with no fans, but until we get back baseball or basketball, kick back, grab a stand of Pilsner, because for now, there's not much else out there except the silent stands of the Bundesliga. If soccer ain't your thing, keep yourself busy on our website, theworld.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Have a safe and relaxing weekend, everybody.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.